What are the economic challenges facing the Global South post-pandemic? What role have global financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF played in worsening the economic situation for poorer countries? And what economic alternatives might exist? In this interview, Jomo Kwame Sundaran shines a light on the effects that decades of liberalization policy have had on countries in the Global South, including deindustrialization, food insecurity, and another looming debt crisis. He argues that the recent refusal to waive international property rights related to vaccines, as well as sanctions on China, have worsened the situation, with the odds increasingly stacked against poorer countries. Jomo Kwame Sundaran is visiting senior fellow at Kazana Research Institute, a visiting fellow at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University, and has previously been the Assistant Director General and Coordinator for Economic and Social Development at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. He's here in conversation with Arun Kundanani. Arun is a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror.
Hello, and welcome to another interview from the Transnational Institute. In this series of conversations, we meet people who can lay out a different vision of what global security should look like in an age of pandemics and climate breakdown. In this installment, I met with Jomo Kwame Sundaran. We talked about the economic challenges facing countries in the Global South in the aftermath of COVID, the global institutions that are worsening the economic situation for developing countries, and the prospects for a more progressive economic alternative. Remember, if you like the video, please like and subscribe and look out for more conversations in the coming weeks. Jomo, thank you for joining us today. Let's begin with the general economic situation of countries in the Global South during the COVID pandemic. And I know it's difficult to generalize across of that whole part of the world, but what can we say in general about the kind of economic effects of COVID in the Global South?
I think it's important to emphasize that the global economy had been slowing in recent decades. During the period of high globalization from the 1990s, we had on the one hand some acceleration in certain parts of the world, but for much of the world, there was relatively less growth. And this contrasts with, let us say, the period of the 1970s, when much of the Global South was growing fairly rapidly. Of course, the 1980s was particularly bad for both Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa. And the 90s continued to be bad, especially for Sub-Saharan Africa. But it was a little better for Latin America. Now, during the early part of this century, we, of course, had the global financial crisis. And that, I would argue, was already the period of trade globalization, if you will, had slowed from the turn of the century. So it's very confusing for a lot of people to talk about globalization as if it is a single phenomenon. But much of the time when people refer to globalization, they're really referring to trade liberalization and trade globalization, if you will. But even though trade liberalization basically reached its high point internationally with the establishment of the World Trade Organization and with all its addendums, which came into force in 1995, I would say that there has not been any significant global advance as far as trade liberalization since then. All the various interministerial meetings have not yielded very much. And what we thought was a small success by the developing countries, led initially by the late Nelson Mandela in introducing the public health exception to the trade-related intellectual property rights. That turned out to be a Pyrrhic victory, as we have seen more recently with the pandemic. So I would say that financial globalization, however, continued. And financial globalization is very much like the proverbial Indian elephant. It means different things to different people, depending on what you have an interest in and so on. And of course, it has also changed very significantly over time. Around 2007, 2008, food prices went up, largely due to shortages of some food, which were already affected by climate, but also by pests, most significantly in the case of rice, for example. The rice harvest in China was adversely affected. But all this affected the growing interest and diversification of financial assets. And the speculation in those financial assets, which worsened the problem of financial globalization and its various consequences, and worsened the food crisis. Food became even less affordable. Now, this is important to emphasize because the effect of trade liberalization in the earlier period was to largely deindustrialize much of the developing world. If you were doing import substituting industrialization, basically that was basically hit very, very hard. And the other thing which was adversely affected is any serious commitment to food security at the national level. So this was also very adversely affected. In the case of Africa, for example, Africa, which used to be a net food exporter right through the 1970s, had become a significant net food importer by the end of the 1980s. And the situation has not improved since. So to talk about questions such as industrialization and food security, all this has to be put in perspective in terms of the trade liberalization which happened. Now, although further trade liberalization was not significant from the 1990s, I think it's important to recognize that financial liberalization was going on, and financial liberalization required a great deal of changes in rules and the use of law to create all kinds of new property rights and new contractual rights. And all this has been extremely significant. So the kind of globalization which we have now is a fairly complex and multifaceted creature, if you will. And it's important for us to recognize that globalization is an uneven process, and it's affecting different countries very differently, and even regional or other so-called plurilateral arrangements have had some effect for some regions, but in fact, there has been very little additional trade liberalization during this period. So economic growth after the global financial crisis was adversely affected. Rich countries were able to compensate by so-called unconventional monetary policies, by keeping interest rates extraordinarily low, defying some of the predictions, for example, of monetarist economists following people like Milton Friedman and so on. But it allowed the rich countries to sustain a growth, to finance recovery, although one should emphasize that one of the major responses to the global financial crisis was the reduction of trade liberalization. In fact, the partial reversal of trade liberalization. It seems that the commitment of the rich countries in the West to trade liberalization was not as strong as often implied. Now, by the middle of the last decade, growth was beginning to slow down. Commodity prices were no longer being sustained by the injection of soft money. And this adversely affected developing countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. We see a decline of growth of demand, particularly from the West. Demand was sustained partly by continuing interest from places like China and India. So it didn't collapse completely, but certainly it was no longer growing. Prices began to come down. So to emphasize, I think it's important to recognize that growth was actually already slowing before the pandemic. And the pandemic became very, very problematic precisely because the response in many parts of the world was to have what are called a stay-in-shelter lockdowns, preventing people from going out to work. Now, to be sure, in East Asia, as well as in Kerala State in southern India, southwestern India, there were other policy measures which were very successfully introduced during this period, especially in the first year of the pandemic. But when vaccines became available, the whole process of vaccination of the world was not only expensive, unnecessarily expensive because of strong intellectual property rights, but also it was uneven because you had countries, rich countries who could afford it, buying up more vaccines than they actually needed. There was a great deal of waste and so on. But the most painful thing for the developing countries was the refusal by rich countries, especially from Europe, to allow developing countries to have a waiver on the trade-related intellectual property rights for medicines, treatments, cures, tests relating to COVID-19 during the duration of the pandemic. It was not an indefinite waiver which was being requested, but even that was rejected. There was some initial signs that the U.S. might take a slightly different view, especially after President Biden was elected, but it didn't come to anything. And the new Director General of the WTO, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, was not able to deliver anything very significant. But for all intents and purposes, I think the vaccine companies, especially those producing mRNA vaccines, realize that this is actually not in their own interest, that there are no other markets left unless you keep on requiring boosters. So, for example, recently Chancellor Schulz went to China, and it appears that China will be producing the BioNTech vaccine under some kind of agreement with the BioNTech company, which is German-based and better known in the rest of the world as the Pfizer vaccine, which is actually not developed by Pfizer, but rather developed by BioNTech. So we find that the means by which we could have come out of the crisis much more easily, much less painfully, and so on, were actually denied to developing countries. Mm-hmm. So economic activity slowed down, which exacerbated things, and most importantly, supply lines were disrupted. Now, this comes following Trump's effort to so-called reshore American investments in China. Now, parts of the region, such as Southeast Asia, our greatest trading partner is China for almost all the countries of Southeast Asia. And increasingly, this is the case in Africa and even in some countries in Latin America. So lowering Chinese growth, as has been done successfully by some rich countries, as well as by the pandemic and the Chinese official response to the pandemic, has basically adversely affected other developing countries fairly seriously. And then now you have two other very major problems. The first, I think, as we all know, early this year, the Russian invasion of Ukraine allowed NATO countries to impose a whole range of sanctions, not condoned or not acceptable in terms of the UN Charter, but nonetheless successfully implemented. So these sanctions have basically, it's a variation, a contemporary variation of the ancient siege efforts. And this has also made recovery even more difficult. The price, and this obviously has triggered the price of food, not only in the short term, But because the sanctions continue to be imposed on fertilizer from Russia and Belarus, this is going to affect food security in the medium term as well. The other major blow, of course, is that the inflation hawks have reversed their policies. So the period of unconventional monetary policy has come to an end. Interest rates are going up, being raised by many countries in the world. But there is tremendous pressure because once the US Fed raises interest rate, there is a so-called flight of capital to US dollar assets. And this has the effect of putting a great deal of pressure on the exchange rate for many developing countries. And so there has been a great deal of pressure. Developing countries have generally responded by raising interest rates, which are slowing the economy down further. But because raising interest rates basically do not address the root of the price increases, because the main reason for the price increases are the disruptions on the supply side, both pandemic-related as well as sanctions-related. And without addressing that, you can raise the interest rates as much as you like, but you're not resolving the supply side problems, which are at the root of this particular recessionary tendency. So there is a real possibility that we are going to have a manufactured stagflation, with stagnation on one side, as well as continued inflation because of interest rates. Now, this may well be averted due to various measures. And we have seen since the US midterms elections at the beginning of November, we have seen a number of measures being taken, initiatives. I mentioned Chancellor Olaf Scholz, but also President Biden finally meeting President Xi, and even hints of a possible negotiation. I don't know what kind of diplomacy is being practiced anymore in Washington, but refusing to talk, it seems to me, is not exactly the best way to achieve some kind of peace.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you. So that was a really great kind of broad sweep to get us started. So thank you. That was very clear. Can we focus a bit more then on the policies and the approach of the international financial institutions like the IMF, the World Bank? So the IMF managing director recently warned that people would be on the streets if we don't fight inflation. And you wrote in an article in reply that people are even more likely to protest if they lose jobs and incomes. So can you talk about the approach through the pandemic and in the period of the post-pandemic recovery of IMF and World Bank and what your analysis is of their approach and what what your assessment is?
Well, I think the IMF attitude has been, until recently, quite unusually ambiguous. Both the managing director and, for the first time, a deputy managing director who was not an American citizen, both of them seem to be hinting at the need to keep the economic growth going, recovery, to support recovery, and to provide relief, particularly for the poorest countries and so on and so forth. Much of this went on during the years of the pandemic, and it was only fairly recently that the IMF, unlike the World Bank, has really changed its tune and puts much greater emphasis on avoiding inflation. Now, this is a very unusual stance, I have to emphasize, because, you know, as we all know, the IMF has been more conservative than the US Fed conventionally in terms of its anti-inflation emphasis. When it talks about stability and stabilization policies, it really is talking about inflation and fighting inflation. So whereas if we think about the US Fed, it has a dual mandate. And some chairs of the US Fed have actually taken the mandate to to maintain full employment very seriously. The IMF doesn't seem to have that dual mandate, but the Articles of Agreement do have a strong emphasis on growth and, by implication, job creation. Article 6 in particular emphasizes that all countries, not just developing countries, have a right to manage their capital account. In fact, however, since the 1990s especially, we have found that the managing directors of the IMF, not all of them, I think there are some notable exceptions, managing directors of the IMF and staff have actually ignored this guarantee in Article 6 of the Articles of Agreement of the IMF. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, if we had a different world, where the members of the IMF could actually demand that the IMF and its staff advise and behave according to the mandate in the Articles of Agreement. And most of all, the US in particular, because of the dual mandate of the US Fed, can really make a strong argument for growth and employment. Unfortunately, this has not been evident for decades. And there was a hint that before Dominique Strauss-Kahn was removed as managing director, that he was moving in this direction. In the case of Kristalina Georgieva, the current managing director, there was a hint that she was also moving in that direction. But as you know, both of them have been cut down to size in different ways. And so that those glimmers of breaking with recent IMF practice didn't really go very far. And it should be emphasized, however, that there has been a tussle in the sense that the United Nations has seen in recent times, especially since the end of the first decade of the 20th century, especially during the time when the late Miguel Descoto was the president of the General Assembly, an attempt by the UN to be much more influential in international financial matters. And it's important to recall that about a dozen years ago, the UN proposed a global Green New Deal as a way of dealing with the global financial crisis. And it actually captured the imagination of much of the world. And we still hear people talking about Green New Deals, although the global part of it is often missing. Mm. And unfortunately, there's very little advocacy of the same anymore. But the whole idea was to have the UN provide the political leadership and for the IMF to provide the technical support for this. This opportunity to change the relations at the multilateral level, unfortunately, has not been pursued strongly. So, for example, on the whole question of corporate income taxation, which has been strongly advocated by the UN and its friends for decades, the OECD has been providing the resistance rather than the IMF. So I think it's very important to recognize that there are a variety of problems which the developing countries face. And increasingly, it's not so terribly meaningful to talk about the Washington consensus. The Washington institutions are less and less influential these days. The IMF never fully recovered from its mishandling of the Asian financial crisis. The World Bank is a relatively smaller player now in a field of multilateral development banks. Mm-hmm. And so the world has changed. And very sadly, rather than member states of the United Nations or civil society playing a bigger role, we now have a bigger role being played by so-called civil society in the form of Davos. Mm. So it is the Davos consensus, the lords of the universe who meet in Davos, who are speaking for global public opinion. And we know who they are, who selects them, and so on and so forth. And this has become a major problem. So I think we really need to begin to recognize that the specific institutions, the specific obstacles to on many issues are not just the old the Bretton Woods institutions in Washington. The World Trade Organization, for example, has become a major obstacle, for example, in rectifying the problems of the 1995 arrangements to creating the WTO and the attendant addendum involving the TRIPS agreement. So I think it's important for us to recognize that there are a variety of interests, many of which are not at all publicly accountable, who need to be named and to be called out and exposed for what they represent. Another institution which almost nobody ever talks about is the Bank of International Settlements, which is a central bank of central banks, if you will, a sort of clearinghouse for central banks. And it's probably less influential than say, the OECD. But the OECD collectively, despite being a rich man's club, is responsible for a lot of the regressive new arrangements in the world in recent years. And it's a shame that some of the larger developing countries have joined the OECD, but have been unable to influence its direction and role. So I think we have to urge them, not necessarily to withdraw, but to play a role which is far more consistent. And then you have the ad hoc arrangements, such as the G7 and the G20. Look at what happened with the income tax arrangement rate. The International Commission had proposed a rate of 25% minimum rate. Janet Yellen, when she had just become Treasury Secretary, had suggested going down to 21%. And one can understand that because it was convenient for the US, because that was the prevailing rate, at least nominally, and it wouldn't have to go through any acrobatics to achieve that. But it was Boris Johnson who basically put pressure through the G7 and pushed it down to 15%. So, you know, I mean, this regression from 21% to 15% was all thanks to Mr. Johnson's doing. And we need to begin to recognize that, you know, that a lot of international decisions are being made by a small handful of powerful politicians who are often working hand in glove with some of the most powerful interests in business interests, business lobbies. And this, I think, is very important for us to recognize. We do not have the kind of centralized world which once existed. The world is becoming, in some ways, a bit more diffuse. Power is a bit more decentralized. But in order for us to be able to resist much more effectively, if not develop alternatives, it is important for us to recognize the complex nature of the beast, because that beast is constantly changing. I thought with the popularity of all those Avatar films, you know, that you would have a much greater recognition that you could have you know, these new avatars, these mutations are happening all the time. But unfortunately, we often find that we are sort of fighting last year's war.
And so you talked about how the rising interest rates coming from the Fed and other central banks has led to capital flight to dollar-held assets. And so if that's happening in poorer countries of the world and we're seeing rising interest rates at the same time, then are we looking at another kind of debt crisis over the coming years?
I think the debt crisis has already begun. I mean, what happened in Sri Lanka and a couple of other countries, the pressures on Pakistan and so on, all indicate that there is already a debt crisis in the making. The exact magnitude of it is fairly difficult to specify. Already after raising interest rates, since the U.S. midterms, the deputy chair of the Fed, Lael Brainard, has indicated that there's really no need to raise interest rates as much as was initially announced. But she seems to be facing a lot of resistance from Wall Street and from other quarters. So a lot of these things are still very much a subject of contention, because it's not only adversely affecting developing countries. we have to recognize that this raising of interest rates is also affecting many rich countries in Europe. And some of the problems, for example, Japan is facing is because Japan has refused so far to raise interest rates in sync with the Western rich countries. Mm-hmm. So we have a variegated world, and we need to be able to deal with that complex variety of circumstances we find ourselves in.
And can you talk a bit about what possibilities you might see for developing alternative policies at the, especially in terms of the kind of international level organizations that you've talked about before? Like, are there initiatives that can be supported to change, say, the OECD or IMF, World Bank? What are the possibilities there?
Well, frankly, I'm not terribly optimistic, not only because the game is stacked against the Global South, but also partly because the Global South is in disarray. It's not very well organized, and it will be some time before it gets its act together. Some of us have called for what we call a pacifist non-alignment. A non-alignment for our times. I think very few people would deny that the only game in town for the time being is capitalism. But we are talking about a varieties of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And those varieties of capitalism obviously have important implications. And then we have conflicts which are not rooted in, let us say, the ideological differences associated with the first Cold War. The second Cold War has got to do with other elements. And one could argue that some of it has to do with old and new racisms. Mm-hmm. But that would take us very far afield. So we have this situation right now, which is very, where there are almost the incentives, particularly for the dominant power in the world, and obviously I'm referring to the U.S., to push. Although I think there is a sense that the U.S. is certainly no longer in ascendance. It was in ascendance perhaps in the first half of the 1990s, after the end of the Cold War. After that, I think there has been a growing sense that the U.S. is no longer in ascendance. And so by around 2007, 2008, this began to reflect itself in terms of a more offensive strategic doctrine, which initially was articulated by Wolfowitz, but with the variation of it during the Obama period was not all that significant. The so-called pivot to Asia was an articulation of this emphasis on a new rivalry, if you will. And of course, Trump took it to new heights. He managed to get a strong ally in the form of Abe Shinzo, the late Abe Shinzo, who was assassinated, and also from the from various governments in the West, as well as the say governments such as the Australian government. But now we have a situation for various reasons, and we are talking about days, and maybe I'm being too optimistic. I'm grasping at straws. But I'm hoping that the results of the midterm has given some pause and will allow more diplomacy. But the real irony is that it is not the U.S. Defense Department which is most belligerent. It is the State Department which is more belligerent than the Defense Department. Both the Defense Secretary as well as the Joint Chief of Staff of the U.S. have actually talked about the importance of negotiations of and so on. But it's not just the Ukraine conflict which is at risk. We saw, for example, the non-proliferation, nuclear non-proliferation and other treaties all go to the dogs during recent years. And so to rebuild those safeguards is extremely important. And that's why divisions within the West, within the rich country bloc, become all the more important. Mm-hmm. At the same time, developing countries will need to get this act together. There are some hopeful signs. Lula's election could consolidate the so-called pink tide in Latin America. But what that pink tide portends is anybody's guess. Even at its best, the Latin American pink tide was never really strong on solidarity with, for example, Africa. Cuba was unique in that respect. Mm-hmm. The Castro government did during the 1980s decisively changed the shape of Southern Africa, mm-hmm. And more arguably. Mm-hmm. But those days are gone. Mm-hmm. So what this will mean could mean the strengthening of BRICS. Less differences among the BRICS. It could mean greater significance of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It could mean the development of a variety of arrangements, including international monetary arrangements, by excluding Russia and some other countries from the SWIFT payment system, for example. You are basically forcing these countries who are not politically subservient to you to go and seek their own alternatives. Mm-hmm. And sooner or later, the excluded are going to get their act together and mm-hmm. they're going to come up with an alternative which could well prove to be quite viable and so on. So, in a sense, I think there is beginning to be a realization the U.S., that they have overextended themselves, they've overreached, and that there's a need to sort of step back and conduct themselves differently. But it's too soon to tell. I mean, as I said, I may be grasping at straws, where the straws might be a figment of my own imagination.
And could you just share a little on what you would see as a viable economic policy of something like a pacifist non-alignment? Like, what would that look like in terms of economic policies that might emerge from that position?
Most people have forgotten, but before 1995, the prevailing agreement was something called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Mm-hmm. And the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was not one size fits all or nothing kind of arrangement. It allowed developing countries to pick and choose what they could comply with, mm-hmm. and this was very helpful. Some countries could not afford certain things, and so on. So, for example, one of the adverse consequences of the strengthening of the international of the intellectual property rights arrangements was to force countries like India and to stop exporting relatively cheap generic mm-hmm. medicines to Africa. Mm-hmm. I think it was Bill Clinton who recognized it was a grave error, and he tried to compensate for it, through some of his philanthropic work, by, for example, buying the patents to a couple of antiretroviral drugs and manufacturing them in India. Mm-hmm. But this is a small drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. You've basically ceded the whole thing to the big pharma, and now I would say big agriculture is another major problem, and a whole range of other things. So we have seen the consolidation of capital being enabled by people who talk the neoliberal language and discourse is one of market forces. Mm. But if anything, they are forcing the market. It's a monopoly control of markets, because this is basically what intellectual property rights endow on the holders of those rights. So I think even our discourse cannot succumb to, we shouldn't have a knee-jerk opposition to, let us say, market arrangements. Market arrangements could well work out well, but at the same time, what we need to recognize is that countries are in a variety of situations, and just like in society, we handicap. The rich people know how to play golf. They know the idea of a handicap. Why can't that principle, which is so acceptable to them and seen as very fair, be extended to the rest of the world? So I think we need to begin to think of arrangements which are much more flexible, which allow and recognize a variety of arrangements. Now, of course, some of these arrangements still do exist. So Bangladesh, in as long as it remained a least developed country, actually developed a fairly considerable capacity to create generic medicines. And so it partially filled the void left by India when India signed up onto the TRIPS agreement by amending its own national laws. But Bangladesh is graduating as a least developed country and will no longer have those kinds of privileges. So we need to recognize that these arrangements, and it's not as in the case of the pandemic, it's not as if by keeping prices high, companies are going to make extra money. No, they're not going to make any more money.
Jomo, thank you for sharing your insights with us today. We have another interview.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI associate Arun Kundanani and Jomo Kwame Sundaram, who is a visiting senior fellow at Kazana Research Institute, visiting fellow at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue, Columbia University, and has previously been the Assistant Director General and Coordinator for Economic and Social Development at the Food and Agriculture Organization at the United Nations. This episode is part of a monthly series on the securitization of health, hosted by Arun Kundanani. Be sure to check out previous episodes and to look out for upcoming ones. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is to simply rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from, and to please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in next time.